And the clock is 4 minutes fast, so we're starting right on time. And we'll end at 2:44. So, heads up. Okay. How many of you live in C building, in living room? Okay. I was just wondering if they were enjoying the pool at the Holiday Inn. So, that's what my overheads look like when I can't get into my office to get the real ones. So, interesting. I just tried to recreate my lecture notes and the overhead. It'll be interesting for me to compare them when I do get back into my office to see what I've left out that's important. So. Housekeeping. We don't have papers to turn back or assignment four or anything else because we can't get into the office. Assignment 5 should be back on Wednesday, and because some of you probably need assignment 5 and our feedback on it to finish assignment 6, if you need an extra 4 days for assignment 6, if you're doing that one, which is worth 40 points, potentially, it will be due on Monday instead of Wednesday. I'm sorry? Can we discuss assignment 6 with each other or with me? Yeah. Sure. What would you like? Guidance. What are you stuck on? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, one issue. How can you narrow it down to 5? With great difficulty, I hope, and a great deal of thought, and a little inspiration. It's sort of... I was trying to think of an appropriate analogy. I suppose it's like Moses taking notes. Remember, Moses went up to the top of the mountain and he's taking notes, which is difficult when you're carving them in stone. But this is an irreverent joke, so don't worry about it too much and don't let it offend you. But God actually lectured for 50 minutes to Moses, and Moses remembered only a very few, which is why there are only 10 commandments. God actually had about 57 or 58 major points that particular lecture, but we only got 10 of them. Actually, Moses wrote down 15, but he dropped one of the tablets on the way down and it broke. So that's why we have the relatively easy task of living up to only 10 commandments instead of all of them. Okay. The other analogy might be that sometimes you have a great deal to say and you're given a short space to say it in, as a writer particularly. That can be a problem, and writers are often challenged to be concise. So that's what you have to do. Now, one of the ways to get it down to 5 is to think about how broadly you want to state your rules. So let me back up a little bit and work into that point. For those of you who have been wrestling with this, you have carefully digested the assignment and know that it comes in 2 stages. And the first stage is to think about Bronfenbrenner and the implications of Bronfenbrenner, thinking about the whole ecosystem and thinking about the parents' responsibility for shaping or guiding the ecosystem that the child experiences. So it's implications for parents trying to provide the child with the most appropriate, developmentally appropriate ecosystem and engagement in that ecosystem. You start with the Bronfenbrenner and think about the implications of that. Then, the rules are for parents. And I'm not hung up, I don't want to get hung up on the technicalities of rules. So if you want to think of them as firm guidelines, the point is, what should parents do? If the interest, and this is the assignment, if the interest is to create a developmentally sound and facilitative ecosystem for the child and guide the child's participation in that ecosystem. So as you think about the rules then, you're writing them for parents, and that means if you're thinking about the outcomes that you want for the child, you have to think about what parents are going to do to get to those outcomes. And thinking about outcomes first may not be the most effective way to approach the assignment. Thinking about the ecosystem first and the child's involvement in it may get you there faster than thinking about what kind of child you want to raise. And this is not an easy assignment. I want you to be aware that I really appreciate how difficult this assignment is. It's not a dash it off the night before, unless you really, really, really have Bronfenbrenner down cold and have thought about how you would instruct parents to apply Bronfenbrenner to their child rearing. Okay. It's not an easy assignment. It's not easy because Bronfenbrenner doesn't tell you how to do it directly. And it's not easy because you have to make that translation and then you have to figure out how to get it down to 5 and still cover as much of the ecosystem as you think is important to cover. So thinking about how you're going to discipline the child at home isn't going to cover it. It's not going to cover it because you've got the whole ecosystem to deal with. So as you think about the 5, you may have 8 or 10 or 15 or whatever. You may need to combine in some way. You may need to broaden them. So if you're thinking very specific things that parents ought to do, then you might want to think about 2 or 3 very specific things and combine them into a more general statement for parents. And as you try to write a more general statement, it may get to be a complex sentence, and that's fine. The rules or guidelines don't have to be simple. So that's one way to get it down to 5, right? By thinking more broadly about them. And then you have 5 pages to explain each of the guidelines or rules that you write. So you have an opportunity to back it up, talk about what the effect of this rule or this rule is likely to be, how it fits with Bronfenbrenner, how Bronfenbrenner supports the particular rule. And so you've got plenty of room to explain it. No? No. Why will he not give an example of a rule? A, everyone would use it. B, the one he would give off the top of his head without thinking about it very much would probably be misleading to everybody in the room. And it, since everybody is obviously eager, it would create a paradigm that might lead people to think that they had to follow that paradigm. And my language and my choice of focus might be quite different from yours, and yours might be very, very good. So I don't want to narrow your thinking by giving you an example that I might mislead you with. Is that fair? Freedom is tough. So Julie is making note toward how I might make it better for next time. John. Oh, sneaky. Yeah, you'd have to cite the reading. You do have two articles by Bronson Brenner in which he does sort of give not quite guidelines or rules, but certainly what he's gleaned over the years. So, yeah, you're not restricted to the developology presentation. You also have those two articles by Bronson Brenner to refer to. Thank you for reminding people that those exist. There'll be a run on the library. Other questions about assignment 6? Some of the drafts, we have two or three. I have the one that I've read over the weekend, which was in my briefcase, so I have systems. Almost done with. Okay. Yeah, if we don't have it in our pockets Wednesday. And that's the other reason for the automatic extension to Monday. We're flexible. I spent a good deal of the night trying to figure out how flexible I could be today if I couldn't get into my office. Hard. Hard. A creature of habit. Other thoughts about assignment 6?
How in depth are you expecting us to go? I wouldn't think it's possible to touch on everything that is so important for me.
The question is, how much in depth? You can't possibly touch on everything that is most important, right? Especially when you only have 5 pages and you're restricted to 5 guidelines or rules. So, as deep as you can, but maybe it won't be totally, you won't cover everything, most likely. So you do have to figure out some priorities for yourself. And we don't have, really honestly, we don't have other than the notion that it really has to reflect Bronson Brenner and the notions inherent in developology. And it has to be relatively clear and supported guidelines. I don't have a clue what those guidelines ought to be. So if I were to do the exercise myself, it might be very, very different from the way Julie might do it or the way any of you would do it. So we really aren't saying, I wonder if they can match the five that we know are right. We don't have a right. We don't have the five. Do you? No, okay. Greg does. But we will disabuse him of those quickly. Okay, so it really is a free-form assignment within those very broad guidelines. And we will read each one fresh. Enough? Okay. It's Joy's fault. She asked. Thank you, Joy. What other housekeeping? Some of you are taking the eco exam after class. Julie has those. She had them with her, so she has those. Anyone else? Okay. Then, here we go. What I've been trying to do and gotten started into over the last couple of sessions is to look at the ecological transitions that are taking place as children enter a family and as they become adults. And I've been reflecting Galinsky. I'm sorry I don't have the nice quotes that I pulled out for those. I will put those on the website. But what is clear from Galinsky's presentation is that the evolution of the family across time is driven by changes in the child. And the changes in the child reflect both new skills on the part of the child, new potentials, new characteristics, and also the child's involvement in new settings. Since most of us aren't raising children in a single setting, children are involved in other settings with other people, and each time they change setting or role, they take on the role of being a student, they take on the role of being a baseball player. Each time they change roles or add a role to their repertoire, that's an ecological transition for the child. New settings and new roles. As the child goes through those ecological transitions, they are reflected to the family and particularly to parents who then have to deal with helping the child understand the settings and the roles and the activities that go on in those roles and settings. So that's a major part of what parenting is about, trying to make sure that your child is adapting to those roles appropriately, that the child is comfortable going into those new settings, is learning the activities that you approve of, and avoiding the activities that you disapprove of. So the process of parenting very nicely fits into a developmental view, and Galinsky gives us the data for that, the examples of what it is that the parent is dealing with as the child develops, as the child changes roles and settings and activities. And as we change roles and settings and activities, we also change our relations with the parents. So, and I'm sorry for my lack of a reasonable pen when I was doing this, so I thought the red might work. Okay. Here's the outline for any ecological transition that anybody in the family is going through, and you'll recognize... that's really bad, isn't it? Okay. Really, really bad. Okay, I'll turn up the bright and down the lights. Yeah, the movie will begin in a moment.
Popcorn.
And the stadium seats are all going to be asleep pretty soon. Oh my God. I'm sorry. Okay, you get enough, I can read it to you. You should be able to write that one yourself anyway in your sleep by now, because those are the major components of a developmental view, right? Dyad? So this is the task, and it's the task for understanding Galinsky. It's also the task for any other change that happens in your life, whether it's a family or a work group or any activity that you're involved in, or any group of people, but we're just thinking primarily about family. So what you have, you should be thinking about, okay, how did the dyad change with this transition that's taking place? Are there new dyads? Are there changes in old dyads? How do relations change? Which relations change because there's an ecological transition going on? Does the ecological transition affect the affect? Does it change the emotions going on? And what are the potentials for that? Does it change the power in particular relations? Does it represent a new level of reciprocity? Is there a way that, for example, the parent needs to become more reciprocal in transactions with the child? Or does it mean less reciprocity? There are microsystems in the new settings and in the current setting, so the previous setting. How do those microsystems change? How does the child in our situation adapt to that new microsystem? And within the microsystem, of course, there are always roles and activities and relations, and all of those may be subject to change. So what this outline does is give you a series of probes for thinking about what is going to change every time the child takes on a new role or enters a new setting. How's this going to bounce back to the family? How's it going to affect the rest of the system? What are the mesosystem connections? If you've added a setting, the whole family's mesosystem may have changed. Or does the child, at some point in life, enter a new setting which becomes an exosystem setting for the parents? And how much communication do they have with that? How does it influence them? And how does this change connect to the macro system? Is the child being exposed to new beliefs? Does the child have an experience with expectations in this new setting? And how do the parents feel? What do they believe about those expectations? Okay, so that's all review. And you should be able to generate that list anytime. Particularly on the final exam, of course. If you have a brief essay question, you ought to be able to generate that list. And then structure your thoughts according to that list. We were talking about authority. I'm sorry. Just... does it work better if I make it less bright? As I was talking about the authority stage in Galinsky's book, the issues are that the child has new skills, and as the child has new skills, it can engage in new activities, and the parent's responsibility is to help direct those activities or set limits. So the child is demonstrating more power, more potential to create problems, and we looked at a few examples, toilet paper rolls included. And as the child is creating problems, the potential for negative affect in the parent-child relationship increases. And parents are faced with a new role, moving from being people who love and nurture children, which may be very easy, particularly with infants, and the parent is suddenly faced, or not so suddenly, but over a period of weeks and months, faced with the necessity to become an authority, to set limits, to say no, to reprimand, to be unnice, potentially, to the child. And part of what's happening then in the microsystem of the family, the setting, is that the parents are changing their relation with the child, the affect may be changing, and parents may be disagreeing about what is appropriate in setting limits for a child. They may have different limits, they may have different things that annoy them, and they may have considerable conflict about how to go about disciplining a child. There is a natural tendency for parents who can't agree and present a united front to polarize. So the most common conflict is if one parent... Did I just lose that? I lost. Just wanted you to see what I was doing. How's that? New battery. In all the years I've been using this thing, I've never actually had the battery die during lecture, but that's what happened. It said no power left. So, there we are. The most common disagreement between parents about authority is when one parent is much stricter and much more harsh and unforgiving than the other. And when you have that combination, where one person is clear and certain about how children should be limited, when the other parent feels that that is inappropriately harsh or inappropriately restrictive, then the other parent has a natural tendency to become more permissive, to try to balance, to compensate the child for the other parent's harshness. So that polarization seems to be fairly common, and it leads people into being permissive when they might not otherwise be permissive. One of the difficulties that happens for children when their parents divorce is that parents who divorce often have those disagreements, and one of them is harsh and the other one has become permissive. But as they're both single parents and dealing with the children alone, they move back toward the center. And the parent who's been seen as the permissive, loving one by the children, those children are often surprised when the parent stops being permissive. And the parent is more likely to move toward being an authoritative parent because there are fewer people to do the parenting and they don't have the other person to balance. So they're not trying to compensate. They just move to now we need to put this household with one parent together so that it functions well. And that may require me to be less permissive than I was before when the other parent was being nasty. Similarly, parents who have not been particularly involved after a divorce get more involved and become more nurturing and spend more time thinking about what children need and become more competent in their parenting and more authoritative rather than authoritative authoritarian. I'm sorry, they become more authoritative and less authoritarian as they're parenting on their own. And part of their explanation for that is that they're not having to shape up children whose other parent is being permissive. The parents on their own often change their role and the nature of their relationship with the child because they've changed the microsystem. They've dropped a dyad or two, and they're not trying to create harmony with children whose other parent is treating them quite differently. Often in the authority stage, one of the issues is the mesosystem setting that the child is in. As children go into child care, parents have the task of trying to find a child care that is congruent, that's consistent, that shares their beliefs in how children should be treated. Of course, any of you who've worked in child care know that what parents do at home with two children is quite different than what you can do in child care with 12, 14, 18, depending on the size of the center and the amount of staff that you have, because most people don't have six or eight children roughly the same age or 10 in a group, and what you have to do with them in setting limits and the way you operate with the children, the activities that you can tolerate, may be quite different than what a parent can tolerate and promote at home. So congruence between the authorities in the other setting and at home changes the mesosystem for the parent and, of course, for the child. And you can see a task for the parents that may be difficult for them to carry out. And then, perhaps finally, in regard to the authority stage, every macro system, every culture, has a set of expectations for what parents are going to do to and for and with their children, and a set of beliefs that support that. The article you have by Strauss reviews some of the beliefs in our society, which is not a unitary macro system by any means. Describes the fact that people have different beliefs about what children should encounter when they violate limits. And then Strauss, having looked at all of the research, has come down on one side of a controversy that suggests that spanking is never particularly useful, developmentally facilitative, and part of your challenge, this would make a great final exam question, Julie, if you could write this one down. Part of your challenge would be, okay, given Strauss, what is it that spanking, a corporal punishment, does to the parent-child relationship? What is the child learning when a parent spanks it? What does it do to the development? And in Strauss's view, if you translate Strauss's view to how parents should discipline children without spanking, how would you explain what he proposes developmentally? How does that fit with creating a developmentally appropriate relation and teaching the child views of the world and skills to get along in the world and to manage the world? How would you apply a Bronfenbrennerian view to what happens when you spank and to the alternatives? Could you defend spanking, for example, from a Bronfenbrennerian point of view? Or does it look like Strauss might be right from a developmental point of view? Okay, let's move on to the next stage as Galinsky is describing it, the interpretive stage. That's not too bad. You can actually see that, maybe. And what does she mean by the interpretive stage? What she's describing is the parent's new role and the task of answering the child's questions, helping the child understand. And obviously, if you go back to Bronfenbrenner's definition of human development, it's the parent's responsibility to help the child construct a valid and differentiated view of the world that the child lives in. So this stage directly approaches helping the child develop a valid and differentiated view of the world. How does the parent do that? What are the issues involved? Children have many questions. They start questioning as soon as they can ask questions, and parents start dealing with those questions. This is new for many parents because often children ask questions that the parents have not anticipated, they've not rehearsed, and as children get older, the questions often are not ones that the parents really understand. It's not easy to provide a satisfying answer to a four-year-old who says, "Why is the sky blue?" So parents have a lot of options. One is they can ridicule the question. "What a dumb question to ask. Of course the sky is blue." The parent is refusing the role of interpreter, but giving the child a very clear view of how the parent feels about the child's questions. So the parent can opt out of the role, but in opting out, you're also interpreting your role to the child, which is, "I don't know. And I'm not going to be happy with you if you ask me questions that I don't know the answers to. So ask me what the home run record is, and I can tell you, but don't ask me why the sky is blue. Don't ask me why I can't wear a dress if I'm a little boy. Don't ask where babies come from, because I, as a parent, may not be willing to tell you." So the interpretive stage is based on the child's questions, predominantly, and it presents the parent with the task of figuring out, what is my role as a knower of things, as an interpreter of things? And how do I respond now that I've established myself as the authority, or an authority in the previous stage? How do I respond when I'm in fact not an authority? I'm an authority in the earlier stages if I can set limits and create clear expectations. But authorities also have answers. Authorities know things. So I have a new role that the child is expecting of me. I should know things. And a question implies, okay, you're the parent, you should know. How do I deal with the fact that I may not know, or if I do know, I may haven't a... I think that might be grammatically correct. I may haven't a clue. I may not have a clue about how to couch my explanation in language that a 4, 5, or 6, or 7-year-old can understand. Why is the sky blue? "Because sunlight is refracted by water molecules in the atmosphere, and certain wavelengths are reflected back into space, and that's all I know, but you can understand very quickly how I might not be able to explain it to a child." So, task. How do I become an authority? How do I deal with questions I can't answer? How do I encourage the child to see him or herself as a learner when I don't know the answer. The teachers always have to have the answers. Good teachers don't have to have the answers. And one of the things that you have the opportunity to do as a parent is to create reciprocity. How do you create reciprocity while being the interpreter? You create reciprocity by having questions of your own, by not having all the answers, by encouraging the child to teach you, by encouraging the child to interpret or to share his or her understanding of the world with you, by having a dialogue about how you both understand what's going on in the world, rather than, if I don't know the answer, telling you it's a dumb question. If I don't know the answer, telling you you're too young to know. If I don't have the answer, or don't, I'm not sure I quite understand it, finding something else to do, telling you that your question is not the most important thing for me at the moment. I have to go paint the roof or whatever it is that I'm doing. So if I want to continue positive affect with the child, and I want to gradually shift the power in the relationship toward the child, then I'm going to have to up the reciprocity. And the reciprocity may mean saying, yeah, I don't know, but let's go find somebody who can. I'm going to teach you the skills of surfing the web. You're four now, you can do that. Let's Google Blue Sky and see what happens. Probably you get 17 companies named Blue Sky that and two CIA secret operations. But you can also find the science website that will give you a 4-year-old or 6-year-old appropriate interpretation of why the sky is blue. There are also several kids' books about the sky and space and the earth that will give you those answers. So what the parent has the opportunity to do is to share the skills of learning with the child and to have the reciprocity high enough to be able to say, gee, that's a great question. I don't have a clue. Let's go find out. And the parent who does that, it turns out, is teaching the child important skills and is encouraging the child to develop power as a learner. The parent who says it's a dumb question is teaching the child to avoid the parent, to see the parent as not willing, and reducing the positive affect in the relationship. Kids who have parents who don't interpret things to them, including it's good to not know because then you can find out, those parents have kids who come to school thinking that they are not good learners, or hoping that when they get to school now they will be able to learn because they haven't learned much at home. But without the view of the world that says, I'm a good learner and I have lots of experience learning with other people. For example, my parents, who are also learning things. The parent who has an intellectually competent child is also typically one who has listened to the child's understanding of the world, has encouraged the child to interpret the world to the parent, has asked the child what he thinks, what she thinks. Why do you think the sky is blue? And then we'll explore that. Okay. And then gradually we'll figure out a more comprehensive answer, a more valid answer. But the parent who helps the child become an interpreter of the world is helping the child become articulate and engaging in dialogue, which is where we begin to resolve the misunderstandings that we have and the disequilibrium that we encounter when we don't know something. The parent is implicitly or explicitly interpreting herself to the child. So the interpretive stage means explaining yourself. Why do you do that, Mommy? Why do you go to work, Daddy? Why can't we drive fast? Why can't we have a Humvee? Why can't? Or why do we? Why don't we have 6 more kids? I'd like baby brothers and sisters. The child is asking questions that encourage the parent to interpret herself or himself to the child. And that may or may not be comfortable for the parent. The parent is also interpreting the child to the world. As the child is getting into new settings, there are other people who want to know about the child. How do you interpret your child to other people? What do you tell teachers? How do you explain your child's behavior to other people? How do you advocate for your child in those settings? What kinds of relations do you establish that get you into those settings so that you can help people understand your child so that they can get along better with your child? Some parents are very good at interpreting their children and advocating for their children, and other parents don't see it as their responsibility at all. When you do take it on as a responsibility, then you have to figure out how far to go. How much do you tell people, and how much do you insist that they believe you? Do they have to, in your view, accept your view of your child? A couple of specific examples of that. I love it when parents are absolutely certain their child is gifted, and they bring the child to preschool or they bring the child to kindergarten and they introduce the child as their gifted child. And so you hang out with the child for a couple of weeks and you keep waiting for the giftedness to appear, and it looks like what you've got is a normally bright, healthy child who's curious. But the parents want you to do more to encourage the child's giftedness. And often, when you're dealing with a group of children, you have a better frame of reference for interpreting the child's intelligence or gifts. And what you may discover, often do discover, is that the child is a great learner and very bright, but there's nothing gifted particularly about this child. And if the parents had had another child to compare it to, they would have been less admiring of the child's wonderful skills. What they often don't realize is that all children have wonderful skills. And the fact that a child is beginning to read and sort out words at 4 does not mean the child is gifted. It means the child is in a literacy-rich environment, and most children in that environment will do the same thing. It's not giftedness. The other example that often comes up in schools is the parents who have not done much to civilize their child, and believe that their child can do no wrong, and are very surprised when the child is in trouble in school, and blame teachers, blame other kids for the behavior that their child is engaging in, which they don't believe. They can't possibly believe that their kid would be deliberately mean or do something that was destructive, because they don't see it at home, so they don't believe that it could happen someplace else. So they're trying to interpret their child as a perfect little angel, but they don't watch the child in the group setting, and the kid may not be a little angel there. Then the teacher, the authorities, have the responsibility or the difficult task of helping parents accept that they may need to change some of what goes on with their child at home. The involvement in various settings has to be interpreted to the child. As kids develop new relationships, they encounter new activities. Competition becomes common as kids get involved with other kids in other settings. They're often based on competition, or at least, as Erickson describes it in the elementary school years, the opportunity to compare yourself to other people and to come to the conclusion that you're better than they are. How do you deal with that? or worse than they are, and how do you deal with that? Do you stay with, from a parent's point of view, do you encourage the child to stay with an activity that he or she perceives him or herself as not doing as well as other children? Do you stick with the violin when you're not the best student in the class? And in fact, you may be the worst student in the class. Do you stick with it or do you bail? Do you stay with soccer even though you're not terribly good at it and learn to be good? Or do you bail? How long do you stay with an activity when you're being compared to other kids? How do you deal with a coach in another setting whose behavior toward children may not be the most appropriate? As a parent, do you help your kids understand the coach and how to stay in the sport because you love it? Or do you pull your kid out because you disapprove of the coach? But how do you interpret the coach, and what expectations do you have for the child? Financial limits. What do you do when you're in the store and your 8-year-old wants everything, or things that you disapprove of, or that you can't afford? How do you interpret the reality of your own limitations to the child? Some parents don't limit the child, so they give in, they give the kid whatever they want, and then they used to declare bankruptcy. Now they can't do that as easily. They're still going to have to pay off the credit card because the laws have changed. How do you deal with wanting to teach a child that the child can't have everything that she sees? As the child is involved with other kids, the child sees that other kids have things that he or she doesn't, that they admire people who have them. How do you deal with your child in helping your child reject those values? Or do you? Should your child have everything that every other child has? Are you a failure if you don't provide it? Or are you the parent who can say, my kid needs certain things and I'll make sure that she has them, but the other things are not necessary, and I will help my child understand that they do not make you a better person. And if your popularity is based on having those things, then maybe you need different friends. That gets us to the macro system, which is on the next slide. What are your beliefs about what children should have? What are your beliefs about the media? If every other kid in the fourth grade is watching X-rated videos at home and your kid wants to, how do you deal with that? If you believe that children should not and you yourself don't watch X-rated movies, how do you create a message system for your child that doesn't include them? How do you help your child understand that it's inappropriate? How do you, in fact, bring your values to the child and create a mental system that supports your values? I'll give you a practical situation that I run into fairly often when I'm working with parents groups. As their kids get up toward adolescence, one of the things that parents begin to do is cave in advance. They start giving up because, in the view of the parents, I know when my kid gets into adolescence, they're going to be doing things that I disapprove of. And I know I can't stop that. I can't be with the child all the time. Their settings become exosystem settings. Actually, very few parents actually say that the kid will be in exosystem settings in my ecosystem. But that's what they mean. I mean, they're not going to be able to monitor the child constantly. They know that other kids in their community smoke pot, drink when they're 16, begin sexual relationships when they're 15 or 16. And even though the parents think those behaviors are inappropriate and don't want their kids to do them, they begin to cave. they begin to assume that their children will. And what's fascinating for me is that you can have a group of parents whose kids are all about the same age, and they're all in the same school, and they're all in the same community, and they have never talked to each other about what their expectations are for their kids. So one of the things that I end up doing is suggesting that they talk to each other, and that they don't let their children hang out in houses where there are no parents. They don't let their children, even at 15 or 16, hang out with people who are drinking. And they tell parents that those things will not happen in their house. Your children are welcome in my house, but there will be no drinking or drugs in our house. I don't let my kids do that, and I don't want you to let my kids do that at your house. And when you create a mesosystem, it is possible to create a mesosystem in which kids are limited in the kinds of behaviors that they're going to engage in. But you can only do that if there is... I hear Bronson better here. If there is direct, face-to-face communication between parents about what the expectations are in each setting that the child is going to be in. And if parents back each other up, then the parent gets to say to the child, you don't go to anyone's house where there are not parents. And you don't go to anyone's house where there are smoking pot, doing drugs, drinking. You simply are not permitted to do those things. And if I find out that you do them, then you will be grounded, whatever the consequences are that you want. And if you're the only parent in town who does that, then you and your kid are weird, and you get to accept that, but you get to interpret that to your child. I don't give a flip what other parents allow their kids to do. You do not do that. I don't allow you to do it. That's interpreting yourself to the child, and it is interpreting the other people, the world, to your child. But if you can create a mesosystem, a group of settings, where the parents all share those values, you can change the community. But I find it very discouraging, as a personal note, I find it very discouraging that parents just assume that their kids will do whatever the community allows, and that parents have no role in defining what the community allows, or in restricting their children's access to things that they don't want. And I guess if I were going to apply Galinsky's language to those parents, I would say they're not comfortable with their authority role, and they're not interpreting themselves or the world appropriately to their children. So they've got two stages they're mucking up, because they're not doing the interpretation. They may not know what they think, because they haven't talked about their role as parents with other parents. They haven't thought about it. They haven't read about it. So they don't know what their role is supposed to be. And we as a society don't make the role particularly clear. Other things that you're going to interpret, other authorities. How do you respond to coaches, to teachers, to Boy Scout leaders, to Girl Scout leaders, to all of those other people who may be in an authority role in relationship with your child? How do you interpret gender expectations? What is it that you believe girls and boys can or can't do? What settings should be open to males and females? The interpreting parent is helping kids make sense out of male and female behavior, including harassment, including sexism, including the inappropriate behavior of other adults in settings that the child might be a participant in. You as a parent get to interpret, or you can avoid interpreting gender to your kids. Friendship. Kids who are in school have friends. Kids have friends, and friends abuse each other. Friends violate the norms of friendship. How do you teach your child to be a friend? What does that mean? What does it mean to be a friend? When people gossip, when kids gossip, when they spread rumors, how do you as a parent interpret? How do you respond to that? How do you help your child understand that it's inappropriate, that it's unfair, that it's not respectful? How do you help your child have friends but not think to the level of behavior that their friends may engage in? That's a tough one to interpret. How do you help your child see that your friends aren't always, their friends aren't always appropriate, but they can still be your friends? How do you deal with behavior among your friends that you disapprove of? As kids' nervous systems expand, they get exposed to other families. That's a two-edged sword. It's wonderful when they go to another family and say, and they go to dinner and overnight with their friends, and then they come back and say, "Boy, I'm glad I'm in this family." They discover other people do things differently, and that gives them a reason to appreciate what you do more. On the other hand, they also go to families where they might, in fact, really like to be a member of that family because parents are indulgent, or parents have more PlayStation, or parents let them eat whatever they choose, or parents don't make them brush their teeth before they go to bed, or whatever else the parents do that kids appreciate. So you get to interpret other families and yourself. Other families are fine, and you can be respectful of them. We don't do that in our family. The expectations in our family are different. And when you're with that family, then you may indulge a little bit, but there are limits to that. And if you're indulging too much, then we can't let you hang out with that family. So part of the parental responsibility in the interpretive stage, as well as combining that with the authority, is to find families, create a message system that supports your values, where your kid can be comfortable and you can be comfortable that your child is there. I think I've touched on all of those, except the last two. Response to increasing development. How do you respond when you realize that your child is becoming more and more competent? And that happens. Children really do become more competent. What do you do when the child no longer needs you to read stories at night? You get sad if you're a parent who's really loved that process of reading stories to the child every night. You start off with the child being utterly dependent on you. You have to have a parent to read to you, although I've noticed some families buy cassette and let the cassette read to the kid. Maybe cuddled up to a cassette player. I guess it's okay. I'm not sure how I feel about that. But it's not as good as me reading to you, I'll tell you that. But what do you do when the kid at 7 is you're reading The Lord of the Rings because, well, this is tough reading, but the kid is getting good enough that after you read your chapter and go downstairs, the kid turns the light on and reads two more chapters herself, and then the next night you come up ready to go to the chapter where you left off, and the kid says, "No, I've already read that chapter and the next one," and there you are having missed two chapters because the kid is becoming perfectly happy to have you read a chapter. Some kids do indulge their parents that way. But now you've missed two chapters and you don't know what's going on. That can be annoying. Then you have to take the book and stay up really, really late to catch up with where the child is. Do you celebrate that? Do you resent it? Do you acknowledge it? Do you ignore it? You say, okay, that's fine, my kid's getting smarter. How do you celebrate increasing competence? Parents are constantly adapting to the fact that their kids need them less and less. The relationship is changing. And the last question there, if you can read, is what to teach? What is it you're actually going to teach your child? What are your values? What do you think is important for kids to know? To know how to do, to avoid. What are your beliefs? How do you share them with children in a way that invites them to share them with you? And is it important that the child over time develop his or her own knowledge and understanding and eventually beliefs? Can you let that happen? Some of the complications, there are several. Complicated things to teach about. One is siblings. How do you interpret the appearance of a baby sibling to the child? Are you prepared to teach about where babies come from? Can you draw the uterus? Can you explain how babies start? At what point do you do that? Most of us, when we have children, have absolutely no clue about how to interpret reproductive activities. How much do you tell the child? If you're in HCFS 65, I hope you're practicing that. It's an important thing to practice. Explaining the process to other people, to each other as parents before you have kids. How do you interpret illness? Is illness something that happens because you were bad? I think in our society there's a natural tendency among children to believe that you get sick because you've done something bad. The spirits are punishing you. And that's a common element in many cultures. In many cultures it's illness is evidence of having done something wrong. It's evidence of guilt. And I think little kids in our society tend to believe that and make that, come up with that interpretation on their own. How do you treat a child who's ill? Psychologically, interpersonally, how do you behave toward the child when the child is ill? Do you encourage hypochondria, because that's the only time you're affectionate when the kid isn't feeling well? Do you allow the child to get out of going to school because she's got an upset stomach? How far do you go in allowing a child to be sick and to limit activities when it might be manipulative? How do you do that? All parents face that issue. How much do you believe the child? How do you set limits on what the child can get out of by being ill? How do you be nurturing but not too nurturing? How do you teach a child to take care of him or herself when she's sick? How do you explain death? How do you interpret death? Pets die. Grandparents die. People die in the newspaper. The newspapers report death. So kids have lots of questions. How do you interpret what it means? How do you help a child deal with death of a pet? Death of a schoolmate? Death of a teacher? Death of a grandparent? What do you believe about death? And how are you able to explain it? to a child who's encountering it for the first time. How do you explain divorce? How do you explain the other parent when you get divorced? It's a very complicated issue, and it requires that you have a very sophisticated view of the difference between parental divorce and divorcing children. And how, when parents can't stand each other anymore, do they share parenting in a way that allows the kid to continue to respect both parents and to accept both of them as parents. A couple of other complications. What if you have a special child? How do you interpret the child to the world when the child has a condition that is potentially handicapping? This is a difficulty for every parent who has a kid with attention deficit disorder. It's a problem for every parent who has a kid with a chronic illness. Diabetes, how do you explain it to kids? How do you explain it to other people? How do you get other people to deal with your child appropriately and create opportunities for your child when the child's abilities might be limited? How do you interpret the world to a child whose understanding of the world may be limited? How do you keep a child safe who may not be able to do that himself? How do you explain handicapping conditions to a 6 or 8 year old who has them? Another complication. The sibling king. Now we have 3 kids. Unless you have twins, kids tend to be in different stages. So you have one kid that you're nurturing and another one in the authority stage. And the kid who's having limits set on him or her is seeing you be absolutely nurturing and indulgent and unconditionally positive with baby brother or baby sister. How does that make you feel when they're putting limits on you and indulging this little... He edited this other creature. One of my favorite daughters, and I only have one, so I loved her comment when her little brother was screaming his head off, and he was probably 3 months old, and Glenn and her infinite understanding and patience was annoyed by his screaming, and she wanted her mother to limit his screaming. Make him stop. And mother was unable to do that at that particular point and explained that. But Glenn was very clear at almost 3 that she would not be permitted to scream like that. But she's a very sweet little kid. So she very sweetly explained that sometimes when her little brother was annoying, she would like to knock his little head off. She didn't. She treated him very nicely all of his life. And it was so sweet that it was all I could do to avoid laughing, because I just want to knock his little head off. It's a wonderful interpretation by the child, identifying with baby Jesus. I love it. Great. Wednesday, we will tackle the interdependent stage. So make sure you've read that and thought about what interdependent means.
was talking about psychological fields a lot.
Uh-huh.
What, I mean, is that, I'm not sure how to interpret that.
But it depends on the context. It's legitimate.
All right, well, wait a minute. I'm not...